A dull November morning. In Birmingham's Winston Green Jail, two guards take the elbows of a bewildered young man and march him to the gallows. He is the last to be hanged in that place. This isn't ancient history. It's 1962. The young man is Oswald Gray. He's from Jamaica, and he's been in England for just 2 years. Not heard of this before? You're not alone. It's forgotten history. A bungled robbery, a single shot from a stolen pistol, and newsagent Thomas Bates lies dead in his shop in Lee Bank Road. The law rushes to punish Oswald Gray. 6 months do not pass from the crime to the rope. Young, black, and disposable, he is a victim of miscarried justice. His story shouts to us across the decades. Who killed Oswald Gray is a story that makes sure that neither Oswald nor Thomas will be forgotten. Episode 6, Hidden History, Rough Justice, and Why This Still Matters.
Oswald Augustus Gray lies in his disturbed grave in Winston Green Prison. Convicted of murdering newsagent Thomas Bates in his shop on Lee Bank Road in June 1962, he has paid the ultimate price for this crime. But more than 60 years have passed, and the state no longer kills those convicted of murder. We need to ask ourselves three big questions. Why has this story remained hidden? Was Oswald Gray's conviction a miscarriage of justice? Why does this still matter? This is episode 6 of Who Killed Oswald Gray? Hidden History, Rough Justice, and Why This Still Matters.
I'm John Berry, and I'm the author of Who Killed Oswald Gray. I've been researching the case for over 5 years now, and I've spoken to scores of people in both Birmingham and in Kingston, Jamaica. Every one of these people has expressed shock and surprise that they've never heard of this before. And when I've asked them why they think this is and why so little fuss has been made about it, there's a common theme running through their responses. First of all, listen to Sue Brown, who has lived in Lee Bank all her adult life, and then to local boy Paul Ferguson, whose dad came here from Jamaica in 1961.
I have to think that it wasn't on the radar of many within the Jamaican community. There were other things going on, mainly making a living. People had come to Britain and tried to get on with their life. It was something that they just didn't want to get involved with, or they may have thought, well, you know, Oswald might have got caught up with the wrong people. Bad man, you might say. And they just wanted to keep away from that. But it was just something that wasn't mentioned.
I think in those times, just about when my dad got here, they wanted to get here, get established, and get in without too much of a fuss. My dad, like most people, had an established trade. They were mainly skilled people who came. My dad was a baker, but the only job he could get himself was cleaning buses.
Get on with your life, don't draw attention to yourself, and what's more, if he had done the crime, then maybe he should have paid the penalty. But did he do the crime? And even if he did, was it a capital offence, even by the tougher standards of the time? Sit tight while we bring together the evidence. It reveals that while it's likely that Oswald pulled the trigger on that early June evening in 1962, something stronger than likelihood is needed for a capital offence. And what's more, other telling factors were in play against him.
The whereabout of the Walter pistol on that Saturday afternoon and evening were never established beyond doubt. Oswald claimed that he had sold it to mover Harris Carniff. And although Oswald, in his confusion, did tell lie after lie, there was never any final definitive proof that he had the pistol at the time of the shooting. In his summing up, the judge, Sir Gilbert Paul, left it entirely to the jury to draw their own conclusion. Is this sound justice in play?
The key prosecution witnesses were a known informer and a renowned petty villain looking to protect himself. Carniff was, in the words of both the police and other members of the judiciary, a man of bad character. And although she may not have received any payment from the police on this occasion, Celia Gibbs was a known informer, almost always operating for financial gain. Were these the most convincing testimonies the state could muster?
Throughout the trial, it seemed that it was the character of Oswald and those around him that were being judged. He had told many lies, often under duress, but that alone did not make him guilty. And why did he tell those lies? What pressure was he put under? Even his defence barrister acknowledged that such coercion probably took place.
The racism of the prosecuting barrister, Graham Swanwick, was plain to hear, talking of the sort who lives in dives, visit nightclubs and share beds. Ignorant, no doubt, of the fact that the sharing of beds was a financial necessity. Similarly, he painted a picture of people who spend rather aimless lives in coffee bars and of whose abode shifts from place to place. The trial was littered with instances of him getting Jamaican people to please repeat yourself. It was clear then, as it is clearer now, that this was the trial of someone perceived to be a second-class citizen.
And then we found that the judge himself harbours the entirely fictional notion that Oswald is homosexual, an imprisonable offence at the time. The man who passes the ultimate sentence carries with him this unfound prejudice, a strange thought, of course, that he does not reveal at the time.
It seems, too, that when it comes to the letter of the law, some letters are more important than others. Prosecutor and judge claim that they are guided by the terms of the Homicide Act, which dictate that murder in pursuit of theft must be punishable by death. But there is no proof that any money was taken from the Bates' shop. It is true that Oswald was known to be short of money, but the coins remained in the cash tin, the till is unopened, and the takings secure.
The same Homicide Act is also clear in that it does not apply to anyone exhibiting any mental infirmity, and throughout the trial, all parties have played on the fact that Oswald is, in the language of the day, a backward child. Both prosecution and defence emphasise the idea of this backwardness, and yet it is never acknowledged as a mitigating factor, either in court, when he is sentenced, or when he appeals for mercy.
When it comes to the last gasp possibility of a reprieve from the Home Secretary, he's given short shrift. Even though one in four cases is granted such mercy, usually young men who have been stupid and easily led, this is denied to Oswald. On later reflection, in his comments to the Home Office, Judge Sir Gilbert Paul concedes that the Act is not fit for purpose.
And what chance did Jamaican Oswald Gray have of a reprieve from a Home Secretary, Henry Brooke, whose first act in office was to confirm the deportation of a Jamaican girl for a £2 shoplifting offence? who only stepped back from this draconian sentence at the last minute, and even then with a grudging reluctance.
Circumstantial evidence, questionable witnesses, a disputed interpretation of the law, and a reprieve in the hands of a racist Home Secretary. Less than a week for the trial, less than an hour for the appeal. No room for mercy. And all of this topped off with a clandestine, undignified reburial, the details of which were kept secret from society and Oswald's family. This does not look like justice.
And why does this still matter, over 60 years later? Let some numbers do the talking. Black youths make up 4% of the nation's teenage population. Black teenagers make up 18% of police stop and search operations. 4% of the population and 15% of arrests. 4% of the population and 29% of the youth custody population. And over one-third of all murder victims aged 16 to 24, 35% are young black people. Most of us don't need statistics to confirm what we already know. The justice system serves black people badly. The story of Oswald Augustus Gray shows us that this injustice has a long and inglorious history.
I'm John Berry, and I'm the author of Who Killed Oswald Gray? Throughout the previous five episodes, I've been the person being interviewed. But for this final part of the series, I'm going to turn the tables and ask local boy Paul Ferguson, whose dad came here in 1961, for his perspective on things.
Most listeners to this will not need telling that in 2025, black and white are not equal in the face of the law. Kids on the street know it. Those who make complaints against the police know it. Even high-profile stars pulled over for driving a fine car know it. This discrimination has its roots deep in our society.
And you're going to point to a very recent example to show how hard it is to change things.
I am. In March 2025, the Independent Sentencing Council made some modest suggestions about how courts should consider the punishments handed down to those from ethnic minority backgrounds. They did this to take into account, for example, that 27% of prisoners were non-white in a population in which just 14% were in that category.
And that prompted some pretty wild speculation, didn't it?
It certainly did. Here are the words of Shadow Justice Secretary Robert Jenry.
This seems to me to be blatant bias against Christians and straight white men.
And he wasn't alone. From the other side of the political divide, Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood, Labour MP for Ladywood here in Birmingham, wrote,
I must make it clear my displeasure at the direction that this guideline took in recommending differing approaches for those from ethnic minorities. As someone who is from an ethnic minority background myself, I do not stand for differential treatment before the law like this.
And is that what was being recommended? Differential treatment?
Not at all. This was just a moderate attempt to address a glaring problem in the justice system. Listen to the language of the report. It talks about how it may be important to consider problems facing particular groups of people, and of how differential treatment would normally be considered necessary. It's hardly tearing up the rule book.
So we can see that there's a clear connecting line between the unthinking prejudice of 1962 and those who, in 2025, face obstruction and delay when trying to take the smallest steps to address such injustice.
I'm afraid that's a conclusion we have to draw.
It was nearly 6 years ago that I started researching this story. I told people that I was looking into events about a hanging in 1962 and that I suspected that there may have been a miscarriage of justice. Ah, they said, I remember that. James Hanratty, the A6 murder. Well, there are some grim coincidences in the cases of Hanratty and Oswald Gray. Both were tried by the same prosecutor, Graham Swanick, and both were hanged by Harry Allen. But that's where the similarities end. Hanratty's case was frequently revisited by investigative journalists and eminent judges. John Lennon campaigned for his reprieve. There were ongoing investigations, exhumations, and the retrospective application of DNA evidence, which was unavailable at the time. There was a movie made about his case, and the brilliant investigative journalist Paul Foote wrote a forensically researched book about it, and I'm delighted that his son, Matt, has written the foreword to mine. Oswald Augustus Gray was 18 when he came to Birmingham from Bog Walk and 20 when they killed him at Winston Green Prison. And he never hit the headlines. My book and this broadcast has been an attempt to put that right.
You have been listening to episode 6 of Who Killed Oswald Gray? Hidden history, rough justice, and why this still matters. You've heard the voices of Sue Brown, Peter Wynn Wilson, Paul Ferguson, and the writer John Berry. Original music is written and performed by Anthony Williams and Sue Brown. Other music is supplied by Bloodline Music. The producer is Paul Toll and I am Chicken George, executive editor. This has been a GCRB presentation.
Who Killed Oswald Gray is a Genesis Radio production, all rights reserved. For permission to use any part of this broadcast, contact the author John Berry at www.johnberrywriter.co.uk.